Right at the beginning of this course, I mentioned that I was going to divide the course into three sections. And in the first, we're trying to get a feel, an understanding of how people who knew Jesus at the time thought about him and how he understood himself in that 2 or 3 years of his public ministry before his death on the cross. That's not an easy process to come up with a lot of certainty on, because the documents, as you know, were written so much later and have all that hindsight, extra awareness that we need to somehow distract from in order to try to get back to the original thinking. And then in the second section we intend looking at how the early church looked at the risen Christ, which is a related but separate subject. And then finally, at the end, we're going to come back and have a look again back at Jesus of Nazareth in his public ministry in the light of the hindsight that they gathered in later years. That's the scheme. Now, tonight's lecture in that scheme is a very fascinating one for a number of reasons. The subject is Jesus, the Son of Man. Now, as I've mentioned to you there, we find this expression, Son of Man, frequently on the lips of Jesus. Usually in reference to himself. And in fact, in the Synoptic Gospels, that's Mark, Matthew and Luke, Jesus rarely ever uses any other expression about himself. So that's one interesting piece of data to observe. The second piece, and when you put them together you'll see my conclusion, the second piece of data is that you don't find the expression Son of Man anywhere else in the New Testament. I have mentioned there do happen to be, in fact, four other texts. In the letter to the Hebrews, Psalm 2 is quoted, which contains that expression. In the Acts chapter 7, verse 56, Stephen talks in the terms of the Son of Man. And in the book of Revelations, in two texts, you'll find the expression there. But that's negligible, really. You could say Paul never uses it, for example. It's not in the letters of John and so on. So an overall accurate statement is to say we've got a lot of use of the word Son of Man in the Gospels. We don't have it anywhere else. And when it's in the Gospels, it's only on the lips of Jesus. No one else ever uses it of him. No one calls him the Son of Man, Peter or Andrew or Pilate or anybody else. In other words, I think this conclusion is demanded by the evidence, the early church didn't find it a helpful expression to articulate its understanding of Jesus. Paul didn't find it helpful, and others didn't find it helpful. They would have used it, eh? None of the creeds of the church in the first 5 centuries and on ever used Son of Man of him. So it dropped almost immediately from use. Can you see the way the evidence seems to be pointing? It seems to be pointing to the fact that if it's there and it's only on the lips of Jesus, I personally can't see any other reasonable conclusion than that it's there because Jesus used it. No one else puts it on his lips because they don't use it of him. They must have used it in authentic honesty to the sayings of Jesus as they were handed down, full of this rather mysterious saying. If that's true, and I think it is, then we're right in touch, and I don't know that we'll ever get more in touch, with Jesus' own self-understanding. This is the way he preferred to communicate his understanding of his person and his mission. So that is the first point I want to make, and I think it's really interesting and in fact quite exciting. We're going to see, and I'll show you now very shortly, the reasons why the title Son of Man dropped out is because it was a very Semite, Hebrew, biblical expression, It would make no sense to a Greek world, for example, a Gentile world. And even in the Jewish world, it was really on the periphery. It was too hard to explain, except that I'm going to make a success of it tonight. Excuse me. But without a lot of work, it's not that easy to communicate its meaning. In fact, we're going to see that the meaning of Son of Man is very, very like what we did last week, the suffering servant of Yahweh. The two ideas come in so parallel, you can see why the early church liked to speak of Jesus as the servant of God, the prophet servant of God, and found in that a lovely and complete way of getting at what we're talking about tonight. So in a way, tonight is another way of coming at what we looked at last week. I find that very important to say, because what we did last week on the suffering servant is vitally central, clearly, and here we've got affirmation that we're really on the spot and directly in touch from the sayings of Jesus kept recorded out of just historical, authentic honesty. Jesus' own understanding is clearly in terms of Son of Man. Okay, now what does it mean? Well, as always, to come to an understanding of a term in the New Testament, you've got to get back into the culture, the history, environment, the biblical kind of background. And so let's go to the Old Testament and get an understanding of it. The simplest explanation of Son of Man is found in Psalm 8, verse 4, where you find the psalm says, "What is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him?" And in Hebrew psalmody or poetry, that's another way of saying both those lines have exactly the same meaning. Son of man just means man. Ben Adam is a man. It's a most simple expression, and that's the way it's used there. You'll find it keeps recurring, for example, in the prophecy of Ezekiel. And it's another way of Ezekiel. He talks himself as a son of man. "I'm just a bloke," you could almost translate the English. A man, an ordinary person like everybody else, says, "Stop putting me on a pedestal and just listen to what I'm telling you." It's an identification with the ordinary. But there is one text which is clearly central to the New Testament usage where this expression, Son of Man, has a rather peculiar ring about it. It occurs in the book of Daniel, chapter 7, where the book of Daniel was written during the Maccabean Revolt, so that's 168 BC, a couple of hundred years prior to Jesus' death type of thing, and I won't go into the history of that revolt with you, except it was a time of severe persecution. It looked like they were going to go under. The Syrian king attacked the city and so on. And those who were faithful to God and kept their trust in God and resisted, in a kind of guerrilla warfare it was, the invasion. This book was written to bolster up their hope and to sustain their faith by reminding them of their past, and promising them, if they were faithful, that somehow the promises of God would persevere, even though it didn't look very likely at the time. And the author is part prophet, but part interpreter of prophecies. They're two different roles, as you can see. Part a seer, who claims at any rate to see the will of God and see into God's purposes for humanity, and can interpret visions. And in the interpretation, of course, he's encouraging the people to what he wants, which is faith. And the particular part I want to read to you is in chapter 7, verse 10 to 14. One of the visions in this book, so-called, of Daniel, is this. It says, "A court was held." He looked, he says, "I can see visions in the night," and it goes off into a rather beautiful, poetic, powerful, psychedelic kind of literature. "A court was held and the books were open." It's the last day, the last judgment, and he's seeing it all up there happening. I gazed into the visions of the night, he said, and I saw, coming on the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man. On him was conferred sovereignty and power and glory and kingship, and on it goes. The last judgment, the assizes, God checking on what is happening in throughout the whole world, and then God declaring his judgment, and there, next to God, at God's right hand, who's there? One like a son of man. An ordinary person. The author then goes on to interpret the vision, and when I show you the interpretation, you'll see the point I'm trying to make. He goes through the whole, it's a longer story, you can look at yourself. Then he comes in verse 26 to 27 to interpret this, and he says, a court will be held, this is the explanation, and his power, and he's talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, the Syrian king, who at that time is winning the war apparently and persecuting his fellow countrymen, his power stripped from him, and sovereignty and kingship and the splendors of all the kingdoms under heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. Can you see what's happened? The Son of Man is the one who had power in the vision. In the interpretation, it's the ordinary people, the people of the saints of the Most High, the persecuted, poor people who are crying out to God, who are being murdered and whatever else, and taken in prison and so on, by the marauding armies of Syria. And it's these ordinary people who are given power. So the Son of Man is the heavenly equivalent of the ordinary, persecuted, downtrodden, outcasts, martyrs of that persecution. That's the piece of literature. It's the only piece, so we're clearly in touch with something central in understanding. I'll now try one more step to see if I can explain to you and get the understanding. There, we now move into mythology. Their vision of the world was like this. There are three levels to the world, their cosmology. There's heaven, which everybody knows is up there, don't you? And that's the world of the spirits. All kinds of spirits, angels, etc. In the seventh heaven, right back in them, is God. Only God's up there, in the seventh heaven. Wow, that's all light. Gradually getting closer. In the second is the level of earth, that's us. And that's the world of what they call flesh. And it just means human condition, sickness, death, ordinary clay, humanity, animals, trees, things that decay and aren't always there and are changing and vulnerable and whatever. Right? Our world, in other words, as we would understand it. And that's where we are now living. There's a third world, which is down there, because that's where you put your dead. You bury them in the ground or in big caverns and they go right down. And that's the world, the underworld, under your feet, a Sheol, they called it, where the dead go. Abraham's bosom, it's called. Dear old Abraham. Now, that's their worldview. Simple, and just take it as a poetic thing. Jesus' prayer captures it in the Our Father. Our Father, who art in heaven, may your hallowed be your name, your kingdom come. Now, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Jesus' whole mission was, of course God's will is done in heaven. That's where God reigns. That's the light, spirit world. But on earth, Jesus wanted to see that God's will was done here as it is done in heaven. Step further. A visionary, in their way of understanding, or a seer, another word for it, is someone who sees into heaven and can see they understood that everything that's happening on earth somehow has its counterpart in heaven. The real world is the heavenly world, and this is the world of the noumena, or phenomena, is it? Yes. The external appearances and things, and that everything happening here, I suppose we would use words like, is already preordained in the mind of God. Eh? Not a good statement, mind you. I don't think philosophically that's accurate, but that's a way of putting it. That God's will is done in heaven. God knows. God somehow foresees the future as they imagine it. God ordains the movements of everything as they imagine it. And so a seer is one who, living on this world, has a vision into what's really going on, right? The reality of heaven. And if he is also a prophet, he not only, or she, not only sees, has a vision, but tells us on God's behalf, tells us ordinary, worldly, earthly people, what's actually going on in the ultimate. Got it? And often they'd be in a trance or something, and people would think, oh, they're having a special vision of the mystery. So, the Son of Man is, as it were, I don't know how better to put this, the heavenly counterpart of the ordinary people, the saints of the Most High. And when, in the middle of the persecution, when everything seems going wrong, this seer, this visionary, sees, hey, look, in heaven it is ordained and I can see it all there. When the final judgment comes, it's not Antiochus Epiphanes who's there next to God saying, you know, I rule the world. It's not this great military leader, you know, who thinks the whole world has to genuflect when he comes by. The people who are being vindicated in God's judgment, the people who are being glorified and honoured by God, are the ordinary persecuted people who at the moment are losing heart. But he's saying, don't lose heart, because look, I've seen it. You follow me? Perhaps I'm over saying it too often, but that's just a simple way of trying to communicate the essence of it. Now, if that's true, and I'm confident it is, then what we gather from the book of Daniel is that the expression Son of Man has a couple of points to it. Firstly, it's about judgment. It's linked to judgment, God's judgment of the world. That's obvious, eh? Second thing that's clear about it, it's a term of identification with the poor, the outcasts, the suffering, the persecuted, the ordinary. It's a term of solidarity with the poor. Also a term of the highest glorification, because Yahweh hears the cry of the poor and Yahweh judges the world, vindicating the poor who are faithful and cry out to him.